Hi, everyone, and welcome to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, a.k.a. Menes, and joining me for this week's edition of the show have my old friend and editor at News Corp, James McSmith. How are you, Macca?
Menes, I'm fantastic, and thank you once again for having me, mate. It's great to be here.
And the other person joining me is Steve Wilson from the Digital Sports Department. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, Manners. Yeah, looking forward to some robust dissection of the England cricket team.
Steve, yeah. Steve, like much of the rest of the English team, are you hungover? Are you getting drunk? Have you been drunk?
My head?
Well, that's the thing.
Wear a raincoat?
Where does it begin and where does it end? Yeah, drunk, hungover, somewhere in between. You know what we're like.
I really like our boss at News Corp, because I wasn't sure at the beginning why he got a POM to blog the whole Ashes series. But now I've realised it was a great plan by our boss to make you suffer through the summer. You have to watch every ball or most of the test. How are you coping?
I'm getting through it. No, I do have a foot in both camps. I've got an Australian wife and Australian daughter. So I do claim a little bit of I can go either way when necessary. But yeah, it's quite difficult to commentate on an England collapse. But I have had plenty of practice by now.
I go the other way as well. I've got an English wife, but I've never once thought about going for England. So I think that's the difference between Aussies and Poms.
I reckon he's only considering going this way because it's 2-0 down. It's looking at 5-0. That's why he's got a foot in this camp.
I get paid by Australians, so that's why I persevere with it.
Anyway, I hope you enjoy the blogs the rest of the summer. Enjoy. All right, so we've got a big show this week. Macca, Steve and I are going to preview the WACA test, and we're going to go through all the cricket headlines. And I've got two feature interviews, one with former Australian fast bowler Damien Fleming and the other with one of the most respected cricket journalists and commentators in the country, Tim Lane. So that's all to come, but let's get into the preview of the WACA test. Mitchell Johnson said pretty much today that this English team is worse than the team that was here in 2013. I mean, is it looking worse than the team that was here in 2013, Macca?
Not yet, mate, I don't think. I mean, I'm coming here a little bit sheepish today because I said that I think last time with Steve, I was trying to give him some confidence. And I do think that those two tests so far, they could have gone England's way, maybe if they'd shown a bit more resolve. But I really think things are starting to crumble. And, you know, I mean, that team really hit rock bottom last time they're out here, England. And it'd be an incredible feat to go lower than that. But they're certainly starting to do their best, aren't they?
I think the thing with on the field for this English team, what's happening is pretty much what we expected to happen. You know, we went to Brisbane and England don't win there. Expected a bit more out of the conditions in Adelaide, and you know, Anderson and Broad at times did show that they were capable of doing it. And Australia showed that under lights with the ball hooping around, they don't have a concrete set batting order. But the Australians have produced what they were going to produce. They got the quick bowlers and Nathan Lyon, who's just in the form of his life, and a top order for England that's looked shaky before we came here has been exposed.
Yeah, it's going from one calamity to the other, though, for this tourist. So since the last podcast, and geez, I'm loving this, Ben Duckett's been pretty much tour over for him, and he for tipping a beer on James Anderson's head. Now, it's amazing. Every Aussie has probably wanted to do this to James Anderson for 10 years, but it's someone in his own touring party that did it. And I really feel sorry for Trevor Bayliss, because usually when a group like this starts to fall apart, the coach becomes the victim. And I fear that he's going to cop it from this tour, and I don't know how long he'll stay in the job as English coach, because if you can't control your players, then your position becomes untenable.
Well, it's an interesting point with Bayliss, because pre this tour, if you speak to anyone in and around the camp, what they speak of his sort of great attribute, the thing that he's good at, is creating this relaxed sort of convivial atmosphere within the team that then allows players to come and produce their best on the pitch. But he's let them off the leash and treated them like adults, and they've gone and behaved like sort of idiot children. So you could see how exasperated he was in both times he's had to front the media. I mean, particularly the last one, you know, and he said it explicitly himself. They're just behaving like idiots, and they are. It's the rank stupidity of it. If you look at what Duckett's done, if you even look at what Bairstow did, bizarre as they are or odd as they are, they're not terrible issues in and of themselves, but everything is happening under the shadow of the Ben Stokes incident. So because of what happened there, which was a serious, you know, we all saw the video, this sort of terrible violence that was there, because of that, they should have been more acutely aware that every little thing they're going to do can be misinterpreted or can be exaggerated. And they just haven't learned that. And if, how many times are they going to do it before they do learn it? And Bayliss did just look like an exasperated parent who's like, I've told them what to do. What more can I do now?
Now, the English have tried to use sledging as a distraction from their behaviour off the field, and they've thrown it back at Australia saying that we're crossing the line on the field and maybe sledging too hard. But they're giving our players more and more ammunition as every test goes on, aren't they, Macca?
Well, Menas, that's exactly it. The Australians don't have to look far for some material, do they? And you can imagine what they're going to throw at the Poms when we finally get to Perth.
It's really pathetic, though. Whenever England starts to lose, they say that Australia's sledging too much. I mean, it's such a non-issue, isn't it?
Yeah, the sledging thing's nonsense. I mean, it's good paper talk. It's good sort of TV discussion about what's going on there. And, you know, they will claim minor victories that Bairstow sort of hold out when they've been giving him some chirp, and Smith didn't produce in the second innings in Adelaide when Anderson and Broad were sort of going at him. But I think the actual impact of sledging, and particularly some of the stuff they've sort of been saying in this one, is massively over-egged. It's one for the fans to sort of chat about in the bar, but it's bowling and batting that wins games. Games, not how colourfully you can slag off your opponent.
Well, it is great theatre. It does look fantastic, you know, when Smith and Anderson are, you know, sort of having a bit of a word to one another. That's great TV. But, we obviously grew up playing cricket in this great country of ours, and that's just by the by, isn't it? I mean, you know, obviously there are lines that you can't cross, but everyone's always chirpy when you're out in the middle, and that's just part of, I think, not just cricket, but sport in this country.
Well, I'm going to say something that might ruffle a few feathers, but I don't think grown men on the field should be really upset by something that another grown man says to you. You know, you're playing professional sport. If someone tries to unsettle you by saying something very personal or very edgy, well, if that unsettles you, they've won. You've just got to be man enough to get over it. And with regards to Johnny Bairstow, I had written previously, but it never went to air, that I thought it was risky of him to release his own book in the lead up to the Ashes series. I think if I was an Aussie player, I'd be reading that book looking for ammunition as well. And if it was some sort of attempt to engender sympathy from the Australian public or the players, well, it hasn't really worked. And that's not to denigrate his story, but to release the book in the lead up to an Ashes, I thought was gutsy, and it's blown up in his face. Steve's looking very worried at this.
Gutsy or not. I mean, obviously, you know, it's a book I would also say it's well worth reading. It's a fascinating and... heartbreaking at times. But I think, yeah, gutsy, it's a publishing issue, the timing of it, isn't it? It's the one time in a four-year cycle or 18-month cycle where he's going to be able to...
I think he knew that it was leading into an Ashes and this would get the most publicity and he would sell the most books.
But if you're an Aussie player,
I'd be diving into that book and seeing if there's stuff I could use. Why not?
That'd be interesting. We should get them together and do a straw poll and ask how many of them have read that book cover to cover. I'd wager that it was a minority of less than two.
Yeah, that's right.
Steve, I think you've missed your cue there. You could have actually, you know, questioned how many Aussie players perhaps A, can read, or B, read books, but there you go.
All right, so we move to the Wacker now for the third test of the Ashes series, and it will be pretty much the final ever test at the Wacker. They haven't confirmed this. They're saying they might use it for some matches down the track, but realistically, this could probably be the final ever test there. The first play to test there in 1970. Australia have an amazing record there. They've played 43 tests, won 24 and lost only 11. And most of those losses were against the might of the West Indies when they had their fast bowler. So it is a happy hunting ground and has been for the Aussies. I guess, do you two have any emotions around saying goodbye to the Wacker, or are you just happy to see a new modern stadium?
I say, as an Englishman, I mean, the part of me, the nostalgic sort of romantic part of me, always mourns the losing of these sort of great arenas that have, you know, evoke memories and dramas that we've enjoyed and seen there. But as an Englishman, I'm quite happy to see the back of it, because it just means it's a place, a graveyard for our chances, and hopefully this new stadium, sanitised and corporate as it may be a bit more useful to us when we come here and play in 4 years' time.
Well, man, as I honestly think we've said goodbye to the Wacker several seasons ago, haven't we? I mean, it doesn't bounce like it used to.
It's very docile.
I mean, if you go back to the test against New Zealand, you know, a few seasons past, that was one of the most boring test matches you'd ever see in this country.
Johnson's career.
Yeah, and, you know, and look at the numbers racked up there. So I think we've said goodbye to it, you know, quite a while ago. And I think, you know, I mean, I haven't been to the ground itself. I've driven around it when I've been in Perth, and it really is, you know,
it's out of date.
Yeah, yeah. So
the time has come.
I guess, man, it's one of the things that I've been surprised by. We haven't really talked about it. It hasn't been mentioned. I mean, the Perth government or the Perth authorities really missed a golden opportunity to crown that stadium with this test, didn't they? The new Perth Stadium or Optus Stadium, and they fell behind in the schedule, and they've only missed it by about a month, which is a real stuff up, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, like, so Australia.
Can you imagine we were building up to a you know, the first day of this new stadium at the Ashes, 60,000 people, but instead, I guess it will, at least the Wacker has
imagine,
a chance.
Yeah, imagine that.
Well.
I just think they've missed it. You know, they're obviously going to have a one-day game in January, but I think they've really, really missed a great chance there, you know, to like kick it off in front of 60,000 and really
ground. You're right, though, as well, that the Wacker that we're sort of saying farewell to is one that has a bouncy deck that sort of batsmen are terrified just walking out into it. And you're right, that hasn't been the case for quite a while now.
I mean, as I guess we, you know, you mentioned it there. I mean, you go back to the West Indies at the height, you know, height of their prime, and Ambrose, what did he get, 6 for 1 or something, you know, just
trying to forget.
Yeah, I mean, those were the days when it was just, you know,
that was the Wacker of old. But we look forward now to the new stadium. But I wanted to ask you too, so the big debate in the Australian side is, should Mitch Marsh come in for Peter Hanscom? And, you know, Mitch Marsh is about at 6, Sean Marsh should move up to 5, and you would all of a sudden have that fifth bowling option that the selectors seem to be looking for, and Hanscom, who's played 12 tests averaging 47, gets axed. So I guess, Steve, do you think Mitch Marsh should come in? And I guess I'll give you my concern that if Sean Marsh bats at 5, Australia's tail, some would say, starts at 6.
The idea of bringing a second Marsh in for this game is less about him or his brother. It's more about the bowling attack. And they're looking ahead and thinking, we've got two games from, you know, the three quicks with no problems. Everyone worries that they're going to break down at any point, but they're looking fine. They're getting through a decent amount of overs. It's just a little bit of an insurance policy because they want that 3 to go all the way through to Sydney and just crown this what could well be a 4-0, 5-0 victory. And it's just a bit of insurance because it's going to be hot in Perth. You never know.
Flat wicket, like we've talked about.
Exactly. That's a lot of sort of overs in the legs of those three guys. So just by having that extra bowling option for this particular game, I think there's a sense to it. But it would be really, really harsh on Hanscom, like you say, because of the test average that he has. He hasn't done a lot wrong, but he looks so ugly when things are going wrong for him. So the perception is greater than perhaps his true failing. But I would be happy to see them as an Australian, bring Marsh in for this one, you know, insurance policy for the quicks, and then flip
see
him
how
back.
It goes.
Yeah, yeah, and but maybe bring him back in for Melbourne and Sydney.
Well, is two Marshes too many, though, Macca?
Look,
have we ever won a test with two Marshes?
I just think, you know, are we getting a bit ahead of ourselves thinking about what might happen in the future in terms of these players breaking down or struggling with the load? But I think you're right, man. You know, if Sean Marsh comes in at 5, we're looking a bit
exposed there.
Yeah,
exposed.
Yeah, we
One
really
of the
are.
One of the strengths we've had is Sean Marsh coming in at 6 is kind of that solid player at 6. But then Mitch Marsh, so he's played 21 tests. He's averaging under 22 with the bat. He's taken 29 wickets, Mitch Marsh, so he's been handy with the ball, but it's his batting that's never really come to fruition at test level. But Darren Lehman said his batting form at the moment is exceptional, so I guess we should hang our hats on that.
There is also this thing that I think is happening with the selectors is, I mean, we perhaps even as guilty as the general public of when the three big calls were made for the first test with Marsh and with Bancroft and Payne coming in, everyone was terrified about the consequence of that. And they've pretty much, all three of them have justified their place and justified the faith of the selectors. And I wonder if there's perhaps a little bit going on through their minds that they're thinking, right, it's like the gambler in the casino. Yeah, the gambler in the casino. Oh, you win one, you win another, you win a third. That's
black,
when,
black,
that,
black.
That's morbid on that,
that's
for
when
sure.
You should walk away. But does anyone ever walk away? I'll just have one more win. We'll just get a bit funky with this one. And maybe that's in their mind. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if you listen to the lot, but Mark wore on commentary on Triple M, and I thought he was really fantastic in the Adelaide, but he, you know, didn't mind patting himself on the back more than a few times to say, you know, well, everyone said our Confusio, we've got this right. So, but you know, they're 3 out of 3, aren't they? I guess I want to ask you, Steve, like, is Hanscom really, or Menes as well, is Hanscom really going as badly as you say? Is, I mean, I was seeing the test live, I was surprised at how, I don't know if ugly is the right word for his technique, but it's unusual, isn't it? I was surprised how unusual he looked, and he didn't look steady.
Look, he hasn't had a big go in this Ashes series. I think he's had three innings. So it's really hard to say he's had a bad Ashes when you've had three chances.
I mean,
I think
one of those was under lights as well.
Yes, but he does have a dodgy technique. And before this summer, I identified that this English bowling attack might be able to target Hanscom. I mean, I said in this podcast, they bowl at a lot of players like him in county cricket that get exactly trapped on the crease. So he is a candidate number one for LBW off James Anderson. So I think there is some merit if you were to rest him and bring in Mitch Marsh. But it's a tough call. I mean, you're picking players for a few tests and then you're dumping them again. It's just a vicious cycle now. And you, who knows who's going to play the next test? I just think there's breeding a sort of insecurity now in the team.
But maybe the players can deal with that as professional sportsmen, you know. Khawaja can, you know, if it is horses for courses, Khawaja can just take that on the chin. It's not like it was 10 years ago when you're in the team for 50, 60, 70, 100 tests.
Now, guys, we're running out of time, so I want to lock you down on your predictions now. Steve, will the Ashes be regained by Australia at the Wacker?
It pains me to say that yes. It almost history suggests it. Everything we've seen in the first two tests suggests it. I don't know where England go to sort of find an extra gear or more resolved. There's no major changes they could make with the squad. They can tinker with where, you know, maybe bring Bairstow up and bring Folks in to wicketkeep and relieve Bairstow of the wicketkeeping, little bits like that. But there's no...
Is Duckett running the drinks at the Wacker?
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's his punishment for it. For the rest of the tour, he's going to be
making...
And not
on my head, mate.
He could bring out the gloves for Steve Smith every second
all
over.
All over for England at the Wacker?
Just, I don't see how they can make such a fundamental change that they can come back in this series and can sort of overwrite the decades of history at the Wacker. So Australia are going to win this test match.
I like it. Oh, you should see the disgust on his face, listeners. Log on to that blog when we regain the Ashes. It's going to be so fun, Macca.
I've got to agree there. I can't think of anything else but 3-0, 4-0, 5-0. But I think as an Australian fan, I think I'm speaking for a lot of Australian fans, I'm just stunned at Alistair Cook. You know, it wasn't that long ago he was illogical. You know, we couldn't get him out. And now he's just...
Is illogical a word?
Well, it is on this podcast. And he's just a shadow of his former self.
You can't defy gravity, though, can you? I mean, like, all good things come to an end. Yeah. He's running down
very
the clock.
Meta in the last few minutes. I think the worry for Australia, and we've lost a few times at the Wacker in recent years to India and South Africa, is if we get conditions that favour swing bowling, again, if Anderson bowls those nice little outswingers and the ball's carrying through, a lot of our batsmen, Australian batsmen, have the ability to nick off. So that's the only way I can see England coming into this series, is if they get all the conditions right and they're able to knock us over for a cheap score. And if they pick Mitch Marsh at 6, that is actually an option. If the English bowlers get on a roll, then they could dismiss us for a low score. But like you two, I'm pretty confident it'll be the Aussies that win.
Menace, are you upset that we're all predicting a Aussie win? Are you upset that the Ashes doesn't look to be competitive?
Do I sound upset? Have I sounded upset at all during this
podcast?
No,
I just, you know. It's...
All right, so we've got a big announcement. The Ashes video game winner has been drawn. So thank you so much to all those entries for the competition. Actually got a big, big response. I'm really sorry that I only had one game to give away, but it was to send in your favourite Steve or Ashes memory. So the winner was Tom McCutcheon, and this is his entry. Hi, Menes. My favourite memory is the 100 at the SCG in 2003 off the last ball of day 2. It typified his sheer determination. Cheers, Tom. Well, great entry. Very popular one, that last ball century off Steve Waugh. And Tom, send me your address and I'll be sending you out a PS4 version of the Ashes game. Great game. Lots of fun.
What a great prize, man.
That's your summer sorted. All right, we're going to take a break now. And then after the break, I have a feature interview with former Australian fast bowler Damien Fleming. So I'll be back in a moment with Flemmo.
Bowling! The Ashes are bowling! Fleming is bowling back! This is a sensational victory to Australia. They look gone for all money.
Welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp Cricket Podcast. Now I'm thrilled to have on the line former Australian fast bowler Damien Fleming. Hi Damien, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, thanks Andrew. Just getting ready for the third test match. It's been pretty exciting so far.
Now, we met last year at the SCG, I think during one of the Big Bash games. I came up to you and I told you about my cricket podcast and how good it was. And then a few weeks later, I see, or maybe a bit more than a few weeks, I see you've started your own podcast. Now, I guess my first question is, was I your inspiration?
Of course you were. But you took the name. I was going to go Cricket Unfiltered, but... No, it was, I suppose it was about 6 months later. I was looking at probably more a general podcast because I've started to ride my bike a lot because my knees are letting me down after all the fast bowling and, doing a lot of riding. And I'm a bit of a heavy metal freak, but, listening to Ozzy Osbourne and Metallica and Motley Crue and all that, when you're riding can, I think, increase the adrenaline too much. So, started listening to a lot of podcasts and it sort of come around to that, why don't I do one myself? It was going to be, pretty general, entertainment, bit of sport. And then when it come down to it, I thought, it's getting close, I better do something. And thought, let's do a cricket one. And my old teammate, Bradley Hodge, who's a unique character, fantastic player. He's still playing club cricket for East Sandringham. So I thought we could have a bit of fun with talking about local cricket and obviously Hodgie's not knowledge at international level, and also he thinks a little bit outside the square, Andrew, which I think's always good, and it's good fun. I mean, you're doing it, I'm doing it. It's funny, you might have been doing it for a couple of years and thought there wasn't too many in the market. There's about 100 of them now.
Yeah, there's lots of cricket podcasts. It's a bit annoying, though, because you're a former Test player. You took a hat-trick on debut. You've won a World Cup. You're on TV for the Big Bash. You're on radio for the Tests. I mean, wasn't that enough for you?
Yeah. Oh, I'm really lucky, very lucky. When I left school at 18, got my HSC results for the kids out there. That's Year 12 results back in the late 80s. And a week later, I'm rooming with Mervyn Hughes, who was probably the most famous Aussie sportsman at that stage. He'd just got his 13 wickets against the West Indies and got a hat-trick. And to think, 30 years later, I'm still working in the game that I love. Very fortunate. And to have a bit of variety, like you said, to be able to do TV and radio and then also, work with a lot of my ex-teammates. So, I wouldn't see them as much if it wasn't working in the media. And then, of course, having kids that are coming through and playing the game, so I'm coaching. I'm a parent, I'm driving around, I'm a cricket taxi. I couldn't be happier where I am right now. But in regards to the podcast, what I do like, Andrew, which you're probably enjoying as well, is, I'm controlling the content.
Yep.
And if we decide to go, there's no problems if we go on a tangent, even though we've got a running sheet. And for us, I suppose with two ex-players, we'll talk about the current issues, but I think we want to be pretty story-based because I think cricket lends itself to good stories.
Yeah, definitely. And when you've woken up Hodgie, he's really good. Usually, sounds like you've sort of woken him up from a nap to start a few shows. But it's the Bowlology Report, so listeners, if you haven't already subscribed, go and find it. Excellent podcast. All right, Damien, I want to take you back now down memory lane because I was there for one of them, and I remember one very closely. Two of the most important overs in Australian international limited overs cricket. So I'll rewind to the 1996 World Cup semi-final versus the West Indies. Australia were dead and buried, if I remember. Hardly put a big score on the board at like under 200. Australia were defending it against the West Indies, but you were given not the honour, but the responsibility of bowling the last over in that semi-finals with the game on the line. What do you remember about it?
Oh, it's still very vivid when you look back at those sort of moments, and you're right. But going back a couple of years, it was about my second or third game, and we didn't know it at the time, but it was Alan Border's last game for Australia in South Africa 1994, and we needed to win the game to draw the series, and AB gave me the ball. They might have needed 6 runs and only got 4. And from that moment, I generally bowled the last over for Australia. So, you know, a couple of years later in a World Cup semi-final, it's obviously nervous, but it's not as if it's the first time I've done it before for Australia. You know, I've probably done it 20 or 30 times. And it was those two again. I think Brian Lara and Chanderpaul were just taking the game away from us. And it was McGrath and Warne again that got together and started to knock them over and got down the last over. And Richie Richardson was on strike. He was smoking everywhere. The Kirtley Ambrose was down the other end. And for whatever reason, Richie Rich hit me for four first ball. And they only needed, I think, four runs. And for whatever reason, I yorked Richie Rich. And Kirtley Ambrose called him through and to get himself on strike and ran himself out. It was unbelievable to remember. We used to do the warm-up out in the middle, us bowlers, and Ian Healy would take the ball and he'd practice hitting the stumps, and they'd hit the stumps and go away for 20 metres and go, "Heels, can you just throw the ball to me?" But it just shows how professional Ian Healy was. He was training for that one moment when he might have to hit the stumps, and guess what? It was an actual World Cup semi-final. So to tick for Heels' application. And then there's no bigger competition in the world in the history of international cricket than bowling to an informed Courtney Walsh. Now, Courtney was averaging, I think, two in this tournament, and we thought he'd actually block the ball and get down the other end, because Richie Richardson was obviously going to finish this game for him, and he tried to hit me out of the Mahali ground and got bowled first ball. And I remember Steve Waugh, you know, describing, you know, it's the quickest I've ever ran. And for some reason, I just had to run to Ian Healy and hug him. So teammates are flying by. I hugged Heels, I hugged Steve Waugh, and then I hugged Shane Lee, which was a great effort from Shane Lee because he was 14th man. But he was actually the third man into the celebration, which showed a fair bit about his pace. But, yeah, it was interesting. We felt like we got out of jail. We celebrated, as I said in my book, a bit like Prince, like it was 1999, but unfortunately it was 96, and we had a final 3 days later in Pakistan.
And didn't go so well.
No, and the thing that hurts me back from that, and Sri Lanka played so well. Arinda De Silva is one of the underrated international batsmen that's played the game, but we trained in the morning. We hadn't played in Pakistan before. We didn't train at night, and guess what happened? We batted first, bowled at night, and guess what? It gets dewy at night in Karachi. And just think, if we trained at night, the result might not have been it might not have changed the result, but we might have possibly bowled first, you know, in the dry conditions, and then batted. But for world cricket, it sort of announced Sri Lanka onto the scene, and they had their 20-year anniversary actually this time last year. And Gurasinghe lives around the corner from here, and they had a celebration, and he asked if I could MC the event, and I thought that'd be great. I'd just rock up with my Aussie shirt, and I was actually Sri Lanka's fourth best player in that final, so it would have been nice to get some recognition.
I've read your book, and I think Mark Taylor gave you some pretty good support bowling that last over in the semi-final. Didn't he say to you, if you mess this up, you're out of the side? Something like that?
Yeah, something on those lines. But the ball before, he was brilliant. Like, you could never get a more motivational captain than Mark Taylor, and just said, you know, it doesn't matter what happens, we're backing you here. And then after a ball, he sort of questioned whether I was up to the international standards of bowling at the last overs. But, you know, for all we're talking about the captains at the moment, you know, with Joe Root and Stephen Smith, and they're both, you know, quite young guys. I mean, Mark Taylor, for me, he was just always in control of his emotions, chewing that chewing gum. He could have been having the worst day of his life. You wouldn't know it. And, you know, now you're retired, you don't want to lose what it's like to run in and bowl reasonably fast. It is emotional. You are running in. You do get fatigued. It is an adrenaline type of event, particularly for cricket. And emotions can run high. But when you've got a calming captain, geez, it helps. Geez, it helps when you look at the captain, his emotions are in check. When you bowl a bad spell, there's no teacups like most captains. It was just, you know, thanks, Flynn, that'll do you from Tubby. And you'd know yourself, I've got to bowl better to get another spell. And that's why, you know, Mark Taylor, I reckon, is the best captain I played under.
Yeah, it's a big rap. And then the next over was the World Cup semi-final of 1999. A special over for me, Flynn, because I was just over the boundary at point watching the game with a mate. And we came down to the fence just before the last over, we thought Australia have got this. 9 runs to win, 9 down, South Africa. Australia have got this. And then Lance Klusener bangs 2 fours off you in a row. And South Africa, the scores are level. And we think we're going to go back to Australia with losing semi-finalists as spectators. But what was it like in the middle? Because I can imagine, like, that was really like a star-studded Aussie lineup. You know, the War Brothers, Ponting, McGrath, Warne, Gilchrist, Lehman, yourself. I mean, that game, probably one of the best one-day games ever.
Yeah, it's a shame it wasn't a final. And we won the final just because we beat them the previous game. Imagine that. And you were there. When I say to people that was those first two fours were like streaky outside edges, am I right to describe them like that?
Look, I may have had a couple of pints by this stage of the day, but where I was sitting, and I was at point, so the ball was sort of coming towards me. They came pretty quick.
Yeah, no. I think the first one was the quickest recorded boundary ever hit, and then that was broken by the next ball, which was about 1,000 miles an hour. But it was sort of funny in the middle. As I said again, if that had been the first time I bowled at the death, you know, that would have just, you know, blown me. But I liked, if I had more than 8 runs bowling in the last over, I felt like I could close out that game. Mm. And I wouldn't try and mix it up too much, like I backed my Yorker.
Yep.
If there was less than that, I'd feel like I'd need to get a wicket here. So, you know, I'd have to bowl it, you know, that my slowy, yeah, possibly a quicker short ball, you know, just that we had to actually change it up. But anything more than 8 runs, you know, I backed myself to keep it pretty simple and close it out. The night before, we'd come up with a plan to come around the wicket and bowl Yorkers, you know, like a foot outside of stump, which you think about now, I didn't even get the chance to practice those. But we'd made this plan before a World Cup final. And we were back in that era where basically it was Yorkers to hit the stumps, they miss, you hit. That was the mantra. So to have this plan, and you're not going to question it, are you, you know, in a World Cup semi. And it's funny, a couple of hours before that, I was coming around the wicket and I yorked in 3 times in a row, Klusener, that angling in. And I didn't think that was a bad ploy. But I remember after the third one going, if I get hit for 4 here, Steve Waugh's going to do his head in. So I threw it out wide and he thick-edged it for 4. So it's funny how sometimes, you know, you've just got to do what the team plan says. But after that second 4, and it's funny, you know, I do a lot of public speaking these days about that semi. It's the semi that keeps giving. And I throw a couple of one-liners in that might be half fiction. But for me, as soon as you hit that second 4, it's funny how your mind thinks. It was, I have to bowl him out now. That was my thought. It wasn't about, we're going to lose this final, or don't bowl a no ball or wide. I was just strong as, I have to bowl him out now. And for all along, I actually wanted to come over the wicket and angle across him. Still yorking, but angle across him. I just felt like that was the best way to bowl to Klusener. So I said to Steve Waugh, mate, I want to come over. And this is the beauty of Steve Waugh's leadership, is he was a great captain, as in he loved players who backed themselves, and then he involved would actually back them. So there would be no more crucial moments for Steve Waugh in his one-day career, because the rumours are he sort of, it was mentioned throughout that tournament when we were struggling, if we didn't win, he'd not only not be captain, he'd probably be out of the one-day team. So for him to go, no problem, for me to come over the wicket, was a real tick to his leadership and also, you know, his faith in one of his players.
Yeah.
So coming over the wicket, I felt a lot more comfortable coming over the wicket. And obviously with the ring field. And then, the next ball where Darren Lehman, the current coach, got the chance to win the game, wasn't it? Or draw the game and get us in. And he misses the stumps from about 2 metres away. Like, we'd only been practising that every session. And Dazza Lehman misses. And it's funny, when I'm walking back, I'm thinking, well, hope that's not our last chance to win the World Cup. But it's interesting, when you talk to a lot of South Africans, they blame Alan Donald a lot, you know, for the run out. Whereas I don't recall Lance and Alan OAD talking after that near run out. They still had 3 balls left, didn't they?
Mm.
Now, if I was batting with Steve Waugh or Bevo, you'd just bat the next 2 balls and then if it got down last ball, you'd run. So, you know, for the 4th ball, it was the best ball I bowled. You know, it was the Yorker, what I was exactly looking to bowl. And I vividly remember Klusener just running. And Klusener staying, Donald's in his crease because there's a chance I can get the ball. And then Mark Warfield's beautifully, as he did. he says he threw it to me. We all know he went for the stubs. He went for the glory stuff. And then I underarmed the ball to Paul Gillie. And it was going, like, it wasn't a quick underarm. It would have been going about a centimetre an hour. So Paul Gillie had to wait for ages for it to get to him. And then he took the stunts, and that's the reason we play sport for. And I watch a lot of kids' sport these days, and just to watch that pure euphoria of, you know, winning or enduring in that case and going through the final was, just a magic feeling. And for us, you know, you're talking about the Australian team. Well, that South African team was one of the best South African teams as well. You know, there was no real chinks in that armour, but, you know, you still feel from this day they haven't got over that South African in big tournaments. That every time it gets to a big moment, and probably only been recently that they've actually, you know, started to acknowledge that they have choked in big moments in white ball cricket. And I think once you acknowledge it, I reckon you can move on. But for us, and I felt at training, we were playing Pakistan at Lord's, I felt at training we were just going to win. It's almost like there's no situation we can't win from now. And as you said, we had a very good team. And then to be able to sing the song on the Lord's pitch, Ricky Ponting leading it. Well, that was the highlight of my career.
Oh, great stuff. It was great for us, that semi-final, because me and my mate had been catching the National Express bus around, and there'd been a lot of very noisy South Africans giving it to us the whole tournament. You know, we went into the Super Sixes game in trouble at Headingley, and then, you know, Steve Waugh century. So after that semi-final, they were very quiet on the bus heading back to London, and I was very happy about that.
Thing is, Andrew, it keeps giving because I reckon, you know, I have the opportunity to speak all around Australia, you know, about cricket stories, in particular that one. The amount of times, you know, there'll be 10 people a year that come up with a unique story, you know, like an Australian in a Cape Town bar, and he just gave me a hug. This is years ago, going, after the first two fours, the whole pub was just giving it to me. And then when we got through, you know, like I was the only Australian in this bar. And I was just pumped, and people saying they were running out of their courts, you know, afterwards, and neighbours were running out of their courts as well. So it says to me, you know, how much the Australian cricket team means to Australians and how sometimes it can give people a real lift in their lives.
Yeah, definitely. And I count myself very lucky to have been at that game. But I want to ask you another question. This is something about your test career. So fast forward to the 2001 tour of India. Australia wins the first test. They go 16 tests in a row, winning every game, 16-0. Yeah?
Yep. Things are going well.
Things are going well. How did Steve Waugh break the news to you that you were dropped for the next test?
I don't know, but I mean, I'm a simple man. I'm a straight down the line man. But when you win 16 tests, and you lose the next one, and you only make one change. I mean, where's the accountability? Well, the thing is, Andrew, I didn't play another test after that, so my streak is still going.
So you're 16-0.
I'm still 16. Well, I played in 11 of them, I think.
And I will honestly, I sat there with a mate watching the Dravid and Laxman partnership, and I said to my mate, maybe if Flemo had been in this team, he'd have just bowled one ball that swung a bit more and he could have broken the partnership. And we'll never know. But, yeah, how did Steve Waugh break it to you? Look, mate, we may be 16 on the bounce, but see ya.
I actually didn't bowl well in that first test. And we played around. And there's another one where the professionalism back then. I wasn't the best bowler going around. I wasn't the fastest bowler, but I liked to back my skills, you know, ability to swing the ball and change the pace, and I could bowl cutters. And the day before that first test, I was bowling, playing around with cutters in the nets. And then once again the night before, and we played two of tour games. In hindsight, I should have played around with them in the tour games a bit more. We decided that if they got a big partnership, Colin Miller wasn't playing. He probably should have played all the three tests, Funky Cole. I would come off an even shorter run and bowl cutters with Gillie up to the stumps. And I just remember thinking, maybe if we'd said this at the start of the tour, I could have had two tour games to work on it. But it was actually in the second innings. We were all over them. And the ball started to swing normal again. And Steve Waugh come up and goes, how about we go with the cutters? And I wish I'd just said, mate, the ball's starting to swing again. I should do that. So I went with the cutters, and the last, what would have been my last test wicket, was the one when I dropped short and Dravid hit it to Michael Slater, and Slats took the catch, and they said that it hit the ground first. So
and Slats, he flew off the handle.
went off the handle a bit, and I'm thinking, hey, what about me? I'm the one that could have had another wicket there. That was funny watching some footage later on, and we come straight out of one days in Australia. And in one day cricket, I used to, you know, bowl close to stumps for swingers, and then when it stopped swinging, which was pretty early in one day cricket, I'd bowl wide of the crease to angle in and change my pace because I didn't want to get cut. I'd rather them take a chance of trying to play the pull shot with two out, because if you gave room for a cut shot to international players, it was four. Looked at some footage and just saw how wide I was bowling in the crease. Now, if we just had a bowling coach or someone had mentioned, yeah, maybe that would have got me going in the test match. But I can't actually remember who told me I wasn't playing. But you obviously you're disappointed considering that we won the last test and 16 in a row. But deep down, I knew I hadn't bowled my best, but, you know, a new test match. And watching the footage, I thought, well, I'll get in close to stumps. But I must admit, I was 12th man, disappointed. And then I think once the boys had been in the field for about 2.5 days, and I was running the drinks out to them, I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror and I looked at myself and I went, I reckon it's a pretty good one to miss, Fleck. Pretty good one to miss. But, yeah, felt for the boys. But it's interesting, you know, the two series that we lost, two of the that are recalled as the two greatest series of all time, you know, 2005 Ashes and 2001, you know, Indian series. So sometimes it just shows where Australia's held in what sort of esteem around the world is, you know, in some of our close losses. Yeah, they're called the greatest test series of all time.
And you were part of it. Now, last question, Flem, before I let you go. I know you're commentating at the WACA for Macquarie Media. How could England win this match? If they were to win it, what do they have to do right?
Yeah, it's a good question because, you know, for 2 or 3 days of both test matches, or probably more at Brisbane, they've been competitive for 3 days in one session up at the Gabba. And then really they owned day four, even late day three for the Australians. But the thing is, they've got to be able to compete for the 5 days. And for me, they've got to turn... So there's only been 200s in this series, one in each test match by an Australian, and we've won the test match. So, you know, nice 40s and 30s, the odd 50 is not enough. So I think Root has to score big. Bairstow has to move up the order. He looks the guy most likely to score 100. So they've got to actually put scoreboard pressure on the Australians. And the thing that I reckon England have struggled with is they're bowling what we would call probably as an Australian length on non-swinging pitches. They've got to go back to pitching the ball up like they do over in England, because the only time they've really done it over a sustained period was, you know, late on day three when James Anderson did it at night, and Wokes actually looked more dangerous when he bowled full. So Root has to score hundreds, Bairstow up the order, and their quicks have just got to bowl fuller. And at the WACA, who knows what we get. If the pitch has got a little bit of grass on it, they've got the bowlers to actually maximise those conditions. But if I'm the Australians, Stephen Smith, deep in his mind, he knows that his four bowlers are all genuine match winners. And someone like Patrick Cummins, who hasn't, you know, got a 5 for yet, he hasn't scored a 50... What worries me for England, this could be the test match where he actually blasts England out and takes 5 or 6 for here. So Australians are the favourites, but I reckon there's been moments and England need to make the most of that. There's times where they've won sessions, they've won days. Unfortunately, they haven't been able to do it over a 5-day period.
You were the king of swing. Is it really much harder to swing the Kookaburra ball compared to the Duke ball?
Not the early one. Sometimes the Duke doesn't swing in the first few overs till it gets rid of that lacquer. So you wait until it starts to go, then you get the buffer up and then you pitch up. But, you know, swing bowling, when the ball's swinging, it's like when they won the toss and bowl first. They really didn't back Root up. Those first 15 overs were short of the length. Now, they might be saying, oh, the ball's not swinging here, but it's a vicious circle. If you don't bowl full enough to find out whether it's swinging, well, you're never going to know whether it swings. So, yeah, I've been really surprised at how short they've bowled. And the red cooker will swing. It will swing if you pitch up. Now, it might be only 10 overs, might be only 15, but if you can get Australia 3 down in that period, or happy days, and don't worry about getting cover-driven. If you're playing cover drives, as we've seen with James Finch, who likes to play the cover drive, got away with it in the slow Gabba pitch in the first innings. Every innings after that, he's looking to punch through the covers on front or back foot, and he's got out before he's got the double figures. So I'd be encouraging the cover drive and swing the ball. The Red Cooker will swing at Perth.
Well, Flemmo, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Fascinating stuff. A great trip down memory lane. And I guess all the listeners, they can find you on your podcast, The Bowlology Report. The Big Bash is kicking off soon, which I'm sure you're excited about. So, yeah, you'll be all over summer.
Andrew, thanks a lot for that, and go Aussies.
Isn't Flemmo a good bloke?
Yeah, he's a great interview, man. It's really funny. And, you know, I think he's always sort of been one of my favourite cricketers. So I really enjoyed that, mate.
And it was good for us because when I said we were, it was you and me, Macca,
that's
on
confession.
The Mount Point boundary
I want to make,
at that South African game in the 99 World Cup. So it was good to hear the other side of the story.
I mean, you know, like
he was probably more sober than we were.
We're probably like him. I still, you know, when listening to that, it's just so vivid. And it really was like that for us as well. Klusener was just slapping fours like they were, you know, missiles, like meteorites, wasn't it? It was just an incredible game.
All right, let's get into the cricket headlines for the week. The Women's Big Bash League has kicked off to huge success at North Sydney Oval on the weekend. Big crowds and amazing TV ratings. And these are the sort of staggering results from the weekend, is how many people watched it on Saturday night. So they had a peak audience of 629,000 people watching the Women's Big Bash on Saturday night. Compare that to the A-League derby between Sydney FC and the Western Sydney Wanderers. It had just over 120,000. And the Women's Big Bash League has dwarfed a men's sport. I mean, it really is a landmark day.
A fantastic story, and you know, a great competition that's sort of growing year on year and doesn't show any signs of sort of halting in that. I do just want to pick you up on one thing. Are you going to be fining yourself for mentioning football on this podcast, even though it was in reference to beating them for the scores? I know you don't like other sports being talked about on this podcast.
I've refrained to mention rugby league a number of times
today.
This
is in no way a bad use of it. Like, I'm putting the sport down.
But Ben Horn's on a warning, is he? Or
Ben Horn, fine. He just brought in the North Sydney. It's not like I talked about the North Sydney Bears in this one.
Sorry, no. Man, is that
just saw some records on the weekend. They had the highest Big Bash team score ever, men's or women's, 242. They had the highest individual women's Big Bash league score. They had the fastest ever women's Big Bash century, Ash Gardner, 114 off 52 balls. So, amazing weekend. And if these ratings continue like this, it will add value to the TV rights negotiations that are kicking off soon.
Well, man, it wasn't a massive crowd by any means at North Sydney Oval, but it just looked fantastic on the TV. It really was entertaining. It was, you know, you've got to give a lot of credit to Cricket Australia. They've scheduled it that weekend when there's not much else on. I mean, obviously the derby was on, but there was a lull there and in between tests, obviously, and they just absolutely killed it.
I've written a piece this week for news.com.au about the crowd safety at these games. And I think the balls are travelling so hard, even when the women are hitting them, that you've got to look at netting in these smaller grounds. We had one young boy get hit square on the face from an Elise Perry 6 on Saturday night. So I think safety is one issue that's going to be a big thing for the Big Bash moving forward.
Yeah, of course, man. So I think that's definitely something. I mean, that you do have it in some other sports, those sort of safety precautions for spectators. Steve, I mean, I know you've been to a few of these women cricket games this summer. One of the points of view I've seen espoused is that in women's cricket, that batting has improved immeasurably, but it's the bowling that's still fallen a bit behind. Do you think that's fair enough?
I don't know about that. The games that I've watched, it seems to be a sort of very decent contest between bat and ball, actually, even in the sort of short form games where it's, you know, a slogger's paradise quite often. I think there's a sort of healthy balance there. I think the issue with the safety and the Big Sixes is they are playing on pretty small grounds. I mean, the North Sydney Oval is one of my favourite grounds in the country. It's a beautiful place to watch cricket, but you are in the line of fire when these top athletes are just unfurling their big shots. So, yeah, maybe netting or something like that. That is an answer.
In good news for Afghanistan, it has been announced that they will play their first test against India next year. Just great to see another test team come in. And the big interest is about the young leg spinner, Rashid Khan. He's the leading player for Afghanistan and is playing for the Adelaide Strikers this summer in the Big Bash. And I can tell you right now, if he was Australian, he would walk straight into our test side. So he is a find, and I guarantee he will make some headway in the Big Bash, Rashid Khan. But there's been a new development in cricket, you two, and I don't know if you've seen this. A T10 tournament kicks off in Sharjah this weekend. That's it. 10 overs per side. It's a weekend comp, like a round robin comp. Like these great players, Owen Morgan, Kumar Sangakkara, Darren Bravo. So what do you think of the idea of T10, 10 per side, games finished in an hour and a half?
Yeah, well, I mean, where does it start? We go to T5, T2, T1. I'm not against it per se. You know, if you've got those great players and you can put it all into one weekend, it'd be a fun weekend to go to. But I think we're sort of running out of margins for reducing the sport down to something that a little bit of a farce when it gets small. Because
do you need 11 players if it's a T10?
Well, it was Super Sixes, I think they played for a while in Singapore or at the Commonwealth Games, wasn't it? Yeah. You get to the stage when you completely dilute the sport, don't you? The contest between bat and ball or any meaningful contest, don't you? When you start to really
skin it down. What sort of rhythm would a T10 game have?
None whatsoever, yeah. It would just be...
It's just throw your bat at every ball that comes down.
We would have said the same about T20 cricket maybe when we first heard about it, so I guess we shouldn't be... We need to see it.
Yeah, like I say, yeah, I'm not going to condemn it until I've spent a weekend somewhere. Yeah, if it is in Singapore, you get Saturday, Sunday in Singapore, and you see some legends of the game swinging the bat. That could be quite enjoyable. But I'm skeptical. I think
doesn't seem too meaningful. I guess that's the slide.
We're always looking
it.
For meaning on this podcast too, aren't we, Menas?
Just in life in general.
Now the last headline this week, and this is something that's touched me personally. Matthew Engel from The Guardian has done what's been called a hatchet job on Jeff Boycott's commentary. So he's written a scathing criticism of Jeff Boycott. This said that he's basically, too self-involved. What are some of the other things Engel said about Boycott?
I think he intimated he's a downright bore, didn't he, Menas? I mean,
talks too much.
Well, we don't get this commentary, you know, in Australia, but sometimes the same things are levelled at commentators on the Channel 9 team. And I think social media opens the way these days for those sort of ugly criticisms. But, you know, that was Steve, a well put together piece, you know. And
there was some balance to it.
Yeah,
but
there was.
This angle would be great on the podcast. Mm. Get him in for the commentary critique segment. My thing is I was disappointed that I didn't write a job for someone first. I mean, it's absolutely made for me.
The problem with Boycott and there are others who sort of, you know, fall into this character. He's been doing it for so long and he has such a sort of pronounced way of doing it that you could do a decent imitation of it, that he has a certain speech patterns and he's always negative, he's always angry, and oh, my wife could have hit that, my, you know, this, that and the other, and so he's almost become like a parody or a caricature of himself. So that's why it loses any meaning once he just becomes this, you know, he's not commentating, he's just playing Jeffrey Boycott in the Test match special box sort of thing. So I thought it was very good and it's a very smart piece of writing, and I agree with a lot of it. But I did grow up coming from the UK listening to a lot of radio commentary with Boycott involved in certain places. So I still have a small part in my heart for him. But he's just become this cartoon character now of a commentator.
Well, Engels inspired me. That's the main thing from that piece. All right, so that's it for headlines. Now, I have a special guest for this week's commentary critique segment. I had a chat with a veteran commentator from the Australian cricket scene, Tim Lane. So, quick break, and then I'll be back with the commentary critique segment with Tim Lane. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp cricket podcast. I have got on the line a very special guest to help me with the commentary critique segment, one of the great voices in Australian cricket, Tim Lane. Hi, Tim, how are you?
G'day, Andrew. I'm well, and good to be with you, and looking forward to a bit more cricket and a bit more broadcasting in Perth in a couple of days.
Yeah, so you've been covering the Ashes for the Macquarie Radio Network. How's that been going? Have you enjoyed the cricket so far?
I have, yeah. I've enjoyed the cricket. I've enjoyed the commentary box. We've been doing it on Macquarie now since the last Ashes series. So we've basically done a full cycle of Australian international series in this country, and it's been great to be back in it after a number of years out of it since I left the ABC back at the end of 2002-03.
Yeah, so I was thinking that this summer there's actually quite a lot of competition in the coverage on the radio of cricket. There's probably three local networks covering the cricket. Do you guys feel that sense of competitiveness between the networks?
Well, inevitably there's a certain edge of that, but it's not all about that by any stretch of the imagination. As for how it came about, I think Cricket Australia were aggressively pursuing exercises that would, they hoped, expand their reach. And I'd imagine they might have had some success in that regard. I think we came on board, as I say, 4 or 5 years ago now. And in the last couple of years, Triple M has come on board as well, which takes cricket to the FM band and perhaps puts it in a direction where maybe more young people might be inclined to give it a try on FM radio. I'm not sure, you know, how all that plays out in the end, because I'd have thought young people probably, if they want to listen to the cricket, they go where they know they'll find it. And even if they don't know, they've only got to ask somebody. But nevertheless, you know, doing things which expand your reach probably do make good marketing sense to Cricket Australia.
Yeah, what about the Macquarie Network? I guess what's your sort of philosophy behind the cricket coverage? What sort of style are you striving for? Do you have a sort of principle or a guiding idea of how you should cover the Test cricket?
Well, I think there's got to be some point of difference. Not that we necessarily pursue that in a way designed to shove it down people's throats, but we use two expert commentators throughout. We also have ads at the end of each over, so that makes it all pretty tight. And so I think what you do get is a tight package where there's lots of content with, you know, excellent commentators, and Macquarie have been outstanding in their preparedness to go after the best. So I think of those available, bearing in mind that many have commitments that rule them out through television and so on, we have a terrific team of expert commentators. And Bruce Eva and I call the action. We sort of try and keep our role pretty short and sharp, but nevertheless there is room for observation and comment. But in the main, it's probably more of an expert commentator-oriented coverage than the traditional one, which I guess began in England a long time ago and, you know, involves the musings and reflections, so on, of the commentator. And back in the old days, it was just the commentator calling all the action until the end of the over, and then the expert would come in and give a bit of a summation of what happened over the previous 6 or 8 balls, and then the commentator would start all over again. Well, things have changed since then, but we've probably taken it all a step further.
It's a great team you've got at Macquarie. So Glenn McGrath, Mike Hussey, Damien Fleming, any of those experts you particularly like working with?
Oh, look, I wouldn't single anybody out, because the rest might give me a hard time after they listen to this and we all arrive in the commentary box in Perth. But you're right, John Embry's in there as well as a regular and has been over 4 summers for us, particularly in an Ashes summer. It is important because it's giving us an English connection, and that is important because we're telling the story from both sides. But look, I suppose if I did single someone out, it's probably Cipelli, who I, you know, we're in the same age band, although he's a bit older than I am. But nevertheless, we cover a lot of the same history of the game, and we both have a tremendous affection and, you know, pretty good memory for all that's gone before. And he is just such an important figure in Australian cricket. He long has been, but I think with time that only becomes underlined, because in many ways he, more than any other individual, particularly with Richie's passing a couple of years ago, Cipelli personifies the corporate memory of Australian cricket, both on the field and off it, but particularly on it. And even when he wasn't playing, when he was a kid, you know, he was so immersed in it all. His grandfather, Vic Richardson, of course, was a great figure in Australian cricket. And so Cipelli was learning at his hip from a very young age and just knows so much about it all. And whether you agree with him or not, his interpretations of things through the years are really valuable to the game. And I think, you know, people like that through the generations are really important.
Yeah, he's got a great radio style, actually, Cipelli. You know, I really enjoy listening to him on the radio. You mentioned John Embry. So this, you know, during your coverage, John Embry said that he thought Australia are a common denominator when problems happen on the field. What do you think? You've seen a lot of cricket. Do you think Australians are a common denominator?
Well, I mean, I don't see every series between, you know, the various nations of the cricketing world. But in reflecting on that comment, it's interesting to ponder where the word sledging came from. And it, you know, it stemmed actually from the Cipelli era, as a bit of a joke among the players, and I think it related to something that had happened off the field when someone had, I can't recall what it was, made a comment or behaved in some way that was particularly unsubtle. Someone referred to it as being as subtle as a sledgehammer, and thus the verb to sledge was born. And it wasn't long before it carried over onto the field and achieved a new usage and descriptive form. And thus it is today that, you know, I think it's even in the dictionary, isn't it, these days? And
it's in my dictionary.
People who don't follow cricket are familiar with the word sledging. And so it is an Australian word and, you know, born of a fact and a time when perhaps that kind of rebellious style on the field was being propagated. And today, you know, it's almost taken for granted that when Australia and England play, there will be bitter exchanges. And some of it, you know, I think is not unreasonable, and it kind of fires the interest of particularly younger people. But I think when it does become predictable and, you know, occurs in every game as a matter of course, and, you know, when series begin with players talking about war and hatred, well, you really have to wonder where it's all going.
Certainly comes to the fore when we play England more than anyone else. I think they have this agenda.
Yeah, although we've got India next summer, and don't expect that to be entirely peaceful either.
No, but they don't complain as much.
Perhaps not, although I think they do. They've probably become used to it now. You see, I think a lot of this stems from our contact football culture, and perhaps we see, you know, within the contact battle, you know, physical contest, players get hurt, they respond to that. And so, I don't know, in physical combative terms, Australians perhaps are just a little more inclined to feel that it's okay to do this, and this is the way sport is played, where I think players from other countries don't necessarily see it that way. And I can imagine that some who have come to Australia and been worked over have been shocked. And so this has ramifications, not just in terms of the cricket contest that we're watching, but, you know, in a view of Australia that is taken by people who come here from other countries.
Maybe we're just better at it than other countries.
Well, I think we're less coy about it. We get in there, and it's not something, you know, I don't think we've questioned all that vigorously over the years. Someone was remarking to me during the Adelaide Test about having played cricket in England and how an early impression was of how quiet it was, that this was not at the highest level. This was in a lower form of execution of the game. And, you know, the cricket field was a quiet, peaceful place. Whereas in Australia, those who are still playing the game at various competitive levels tell me that, you know, it's anything but that, virtually at all levels of the game. And certainly what kids see, and I know that from my own experience, that when I was playing a bit of regular competitive cricket in the early 1970s and this sort of thing was becoming the norm, I was influenced by that. And I do recall a game or two where I did things that I don't feel particularly proud of when I reflect.
Yeah, I played cricket in England and Australia when I was younger. And yeah, I definitely copped it more in Australia. It was a lot more just F off from the bowler. Whereas in England, they tried to make jokes to put you off your game. And they certainly sledge over there. But look, I want to let you go. But before I do, I want to ask you one question. Can England come back into the series at the WACA next week?
I doubt it very much. The fact that it's at the WACA, if it's got any pace and bounce, won't help. But I think our bowling attack is just too powerful for their batting lineup, and they've come here with an unproven batting lineup, and of their two mainstays, Cook and Root. Cook, you know, is now really seriously having his future questioned. It must be hard when you've done all that he has, played for as long as he has. And I think too, when you hand over the reins of leadership, when your career has actually gone into some sort of climb over the top of a hill, and you've started riding into the sunset, and you're not the same hungry, ambitious cricketer that you were when you were on the way up. So, I mean, that's just about Alistair Cook and people who experienced that syndrome. But, you know, with three players in the top six who came here never having scored a test century between them, they really are thin on the ground. And we have a very, very good attack right now. And I think it's only going to get better unless the dreaded curse of injury starts to rear its ugly head.
It's great news. So you're expecting we will regain the Ashes at the Wacker, and you never know, you might be calling it.
You never know. You never know. We, of course, began 2013-14 not really expected to win, or not expected to win easily, and yet by Perth it was all wrapped up. It was 3-0, and we might well be in the same situation. I guess all the tickets have been booked up for Melbourne and Sydney, but it is really disappointing that the two biggest draw cards might well, again, be dead rubbers. And that's something for Cricket Australia to have a think about. We sort of have this template these days, which isn't likely to be tampered with because it's comfortable, and you know, the administration wants to preserve so much room now for the shortest form of the game, and that starts to get into, well, very much in a full swing into the new year. But I think it's a great pity that the summer of cricket is all over by, you know, about 10 days into January each year now, and that you can have series like this that are decided well before Christmas, and that the two grounds that, I was going to say, draw the biggest crowds, but Adelaide actually draws the second biggest crowd now, the two biggest cities in the country, and, you know, all the people who are planning on going to the test matches there won't see games that are relevant to the outcome of the series.
It's funny, though, that you say it's the Cricket Australia sticks to this schedule. You know, next summer, all the talk is that India are throwing a massive spanner in the works, so they won't come out as early as England have come out, and we might see actually a Boxing Day and a New Year's test that do have some meaning against India. So, you know, India makes a call and Australia jumps.
Yes, well, I'm not sure how that's going to play out, but I am encouraged by the fact that there's talk of a couple of test matches being played further into January, because Sri Lanka will be coming as well. And as one who fondly recalls Australia Day weekends at the Adelaide Oval and times when we went back to school and you had the last test of a series, sometimes the deciding test of a rubber, such as when the West Indies were here in 60-61. They're fond memories, and it truly was a summer of test cricket in those days. I don't imagine it's going to be on a regular basis, but if there is test cricket right through January next year, I think that'd be really good.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time and coming on the podcast. It was a real pleasure to have one of the great commentators in the country on the show. So good luck for the rest of the summer, and we'll catch up with you on the radio.
Thanks, Andrew. Pleasure to talk to you.
Well, that's it for the podcast this week. Thanks for coming in, Steve, and suffering through our jokes.
Yeah, more than happy. Yeah, looking forward to the ratcheting it up when it goes 4 and 5.
Thank you. And Macca, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's been a pleasure, mate. Bottoms up, Steve.
And remember, listeners, we will be back with daily Ashes reports during the Wacker Test. The Big Bash kicks off next week in Sydney, Thunder v the Sixers. So the cricket season is ramping up full time now. And we'll be back next week with another podcast.